Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome, everybody, to Tremendous Life Radio. We're honored and excited to have Dr. Bernie Siegel back on the show with us. Bernie's work and his name is known across the planet and really needs no introduction at all. He's a physician and an author, and I'm not sure what his latest work is after talking to him. I thought it was a book of miracles, but we'll let him tell us about it. Bernie, thank you for coming back to Tremendous Life Radio.
Well, thank you. And I have to start with a story, too, because, you know, it's how do you have a tremendous life? In college, the only C I got in 4 years was in creative writing, because I was an artist as a young man. It's part of why I became a surgeon. I wanted to continue to use my hands, you know, to create things. So I'm a painter, and I took a course in writing and ended up with a C. Well, years later, what happens? My first book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, becomes a bestseller, number one, New York Times, you know, list, bestseller list. So I wrote my college because of my sense of humor. I wrote and said, if you give me a B because of what I've accomplished, I would be graduating summa cum laude. See? And I got this serious letter back. I was expecting a humorous letter back, you know, that they had laughed in the office of the dean, but saying we cannot alter grades after graduation. And, you know, this full page letter telling me what they can't do. And I felt sorry for them. But I think it shows us. See, what I call it is when you choose life, because you mentioned a book of miracles. All these stories that people sent, and I think it is our latest book, but all these stories that people sent, when I read them, and they're not just about recovering from illness. I mean, they're about all kinds of so-called coincidences in life that you end up saying, boy, that's a miracle. But they're not. They're created by our actions. As Jung said, the future is prepared unconsciously, long in advance, and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance. So you choose life. That's the theme that I found in this. I place before you life and death, good and evil. Choose life. And what I felt was that these people chose what was life-enhancing, but not in a selfish way, not what's best for me. See, that would be good. But what is best for everyone? And that's when wonderful things happened. And even my writing a book. After I gave a lecture one night, a man came out of the audience and said, did you ever consider writing a book? And I said, no, because it's not something I'm good at, and I never thought about it. And he said, but you could help a lot more people with a book than trying to talk to everybody. And what happens? He got in touch with people who got in touch with people, mm-hmm. and none of the original people were involved, but they each got someone else until we found a publisher and a writer. And what did I do? What I'm doing with you. I sat down with a tape recorder and talked for hours and hours and hours as if I were talking to people. And then the writer put it together and came up with a wonderful book. You know, my content, and my wife was a help too, because she'd say, honey, that doesn't sound like you. You know, in other words, if she was reading what he wrote, we would turn it back into Bernie Siegel talk. And it came out, and people felt it was like talking to me, and it was a benefit. And then I learned that, you know, whether you're sitting in front of the computer or writing a letter, because I wrote innumerable letters every night to people before, you know, the emails came out, trying to help them, that if you just let your mind flow, well, let your heart make up your mind is a term I like. If you just let it flow, then you didn't get into trouble. And that the reason I got a C years ago was I was busy thinking, how do I do it right? How do I say the right thing? How do I write, you know? And that's why it came out so intellectual that nobody enjoyed it. But when I learned to just talk to people, then it happened. And I'd say we all need to remember that, just to let it flow, stop thinking. Well, to quote a lawyer, then I'll take a breath. He said, in the midst of a tragedy, I came to a conclusion that was eminently reasonable, totally logical and completely wrong, because while learning to think, I almost forgot how to feel. And I can say to all the men out there listening, please pay attention to relationships and feelings. Don't come into the office and say, there's no point in living, I can't work anymore. And that's a quote from many men, while your wife and children are sitting next to you. And let me say to the women, don't tell me I can't die till they're all married and out of the house, because when they do, what's left of your life? So to the women, bring yourself up. Be your own child. Be your own mother. Take good care of yourself. And to the men, think about relationships and feel and use your heart. Don't just think, but become a complete person. And pay attention to the dreams. And the and what I tell people to do is do drawings. Because the other book before that, The Art of Healing, I learned when I drew pictures for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross how much was stored up inside of me. And that I mean literally to the folks. Your life is stored in you. It's not just from me. That's from psychologists and others. And even from organ transplants. And the people receiving the organ wake up with information about the life of the donor. Believe me, there are books written about that too. But when I drew pictures for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, an outdoor scene, she had such meaningful questions for me. The most important, Bernie, what are you covering up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, this is a white piece of paper I gave you with crayons, and you took a white crayon and made snow on the mountain. But the page is already white. You added a layer. What are you covering up? And it was all about my feelings, literally. That's part of why I was seeking her help. The pain of being a doctor that I wasn't trained to deal with. So I started getting my patients to do drawings, thought I was discovering incredible and amazing things, which medical journals wouldn't publish because it was interesting but not appropriate. And the psychological journal said, yes, it's appropriate, but it's not interesting. We know this. That upset me too. That medicine is not integrated. It's not about caring for people. I always say that your body is treated like your house. You got a plumbing problem, you get a plumber. You know what I mean? The plumber doesn't come in and say, let me look it over, see how the roof is and the electricity is. But, you know, if you go to a doctor, say, I'm going to have a heart problem, the doctor ought to say what's going on in your life, too. There's an ad in a medical journal. This is a quote from it. I was depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel better now. And of course, the ad was for that antidepressant. And I wrote the company and said, I've had a tragedy in my life. Don't you think the doctor ought to say what's going on in your life, not just here's a pill? And they canceled the ad. I couldn't get them to put a line in that just said, sit down, tell me what's happening in your life. You know? And then you put in, he prescribed an antidepressant, and I feel better now. But at least to know what's happening in the person's life, because you cannot separate your feelings from your body chemistry. Laugh for no reason 4 or 5 times a day, you'll live a longer, healthier life. When this study was done in cancer patients, those who laughed for no apparent reason every few hours had a better survival statistic, you know, years later at the end of the study, than people who only laughed if something funny came up. And so the support groups and a whole host of things that I was criticized for and, you know, called crazy by doctors. Because why would it make a difference, you know, if you help people to live or they join support groups? And when people did studies to prove I was wrong and it came out I was right, then it made a difference because they had nothing to gain by agreeing with me. You see, if I did the study, I've learned that, they'd say, oh, well, he probably fudged the control group. Oh, and these things have happened. I mean, a professor at Yale told one of the graduate students that his study couldn't be true because he did a study of Bernie Siegel's group patients. They had better survival statistics, and his professor said it can't be true. Change the control group so it all came out even. Now, you see, that's when you run into trouble. So I would say to people also, live by your experience, not your belief. Don't let your beliefs block your experience of life. And especially the health professionals and others. If people do well, ask them, why didn't you die when you were supposed to? And let them tell you what they did. Again, psychologists understand this. They've written more books about it and used personalities to predict outcome of diseases. And they're correct. You know, you can give them 24 personalities of people with a disease, life-threatening illness, and 80 or 90% of the time, just from their personalities, they'll tell you who will do well and who won't. And let me, I always say I'll take a breath and then I don't, but let me give you a simple example. When people are told they have a couple of months to live, and then, see, wake up and say, okay, then let me do, you know, let me live my chocolate ice cream. Let me do what makes me happy. I'm moving to Colorado. It's beautiful in the mountains. I'm buying a house on the ocean. I'm getting a dog and putting in a backyard wildlife habitat. None of those people died in a few months. I'm laughing because I called up one family to say, how come you didn't call me for the funeral? I told you I wanted to come. And the man, I thought, had died, answered the phone. And this was a guy in Colorado. He said, oh, it's so beautiful here, I forgot to die. Yeah. And that's a year later, you see. So, yeah, he and I are laughing on the phone, but it made a difference. And I say to people, that's why I call it your chocolate ice cream. Live your chocolate ice cream, whatever it is. You know, if you know you have a limited time, go live it. And your body will get a very different message. You see, then it's not Monday morning where we have more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses.
Okay. I love it, Bertie. You're like, just, are you breathing? You're breathing. I want, you know, you bring up so much. And I mean, I could just listen to you for hours. You're one of my favorite guests because I really don't have to say anything. I love that. The wisdom that comes from, I mean that with all just respect, you know, so. You mentioned a couple times early on that, you know, if it would help somebody, did you just wake up? I mean, you've spent countless thousands of hours looking to help people. How did that all come about?
What changed me was years ago, you know, feeling helpless. I mean, as I said, one of the things we need to do with every profession is when you're being trained to say, why do you want to be a doctor, a plumber, a landscaper, you know, whatever. And then look at the healthy and unhealthy reasons. You see, my list for wanting to be a doctor were healthy reasons. I like people, want to fix things, wanted to use my hands. Science was fascinating. But people were a part of it, see. When I talked about drawing, you ask medical students, draw yourself working as a doctor, and you'd be amazed that 95% of the pictures don't have another human being in the picture. I'm sitting behind a desk with a diploma on the wall. And you'd say, but what about people? Oh, people. Yeah. So when the people come in, they're not happy. And I did it for what I called healthy reasons. And then I couldn't cure everything. It was so painful. And there was nobody to help me. It's not something you talk about at the hospital. If your patient dies, you discuss the death and classify it, and whether you could have done anything better, you know, that type of thing. Well, I went to a meeting I thought was four doctors by Dr. Carl Simonton back in the 70s. He wrote the book Getting Well Again. And it was about imagery and, you know, change in lifestyle and other things. I was the only doctor out of 125 people in the room. I could not believe it because it seemed to me that this was four doctors by a doctor. But sitting around me now were my patients. And I always say that doctors and others, put your desk against the wall and don't separate yourself from your patients. Anyway, sitting next to me was a young woman with breast cancer that I had taken care of. She said, Bernie, you're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits. That changed my life. Matter of fact, one of my partners was a very intuitive man, Richard Selzer. He's written books too. We did not have a normal surgical practice, believe me. But I came back to the office on Monday, see, having spent the weekend at the workshop. And he said, Bernie, you're gone. I said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, you're a totally different person than you were on Friday. You're going to quit surgery. And 10 years later, I did retire from surgery. Because I realize I can help more people running support groups, giving lectures, than I can if I'm in the office every day, you know, seeing one at a time kind of thing. Even though my day is off, I did run support groups. But the other thing that woke me up was we sent out 100 letters to people with cancer from our office saying, you want to live a longer, better life, come to a meeting. I expected hundreds of people to show up because the secretary forgot to say this is only for those people who get this letter. You can't bring friends and relatives. And 12 women showed up. That blew my mind, too. I'm saying, you want to live a longer, better life, come to a meeting. I thought, what the hell you got afraid of? Why didn't you all show up? Well, then you learn. You know, the guilt, shame, and blame that people grow up with. God is punishing me. I deserve this. You know, if I try to get better and I don't, then I'm a failure again. Parenting is an incredible issue related to health. If you grow up with love, a study of Harvard students, in middle age, 1 out of 4 had suffered a major illness. Those who, while attending Harvard, said my parents didn't love me, 98% had suffered a major illness. So I found what I call reparenting patients made a difference too, that I'd never rejected them. I always gave them return appointments, even if they were self-destructive. I would still let them know I care about you. And I realized that 6 months down the road, they would suddenly begin to change their behavior. And I knew it was because I never gave up. And as one young lady said, became her CD. And that stands for Chosen Dad. And so, again, you know, what we can do for each other, school teachers, clergy, you know, I look at the present Pope, how he goes around letting people know he cares. Because about 200 years ago now, Pope Leo XII in the early 1800s declared that if you vaccinate yourself against smallpox, you're not going to heaven. Now you'd say, why would he say that? Because God decides who gets smallpox. So if you vaccinate yourself, you're no longer a child of God. How would you like that, you know, today, say? Don't treat your disease because God, well, sometimes I hold back mentioning, but somebody wrote to Billy Graham when he had a newspaper column, and I couldn't believe it. I was reading it a couple of years ago. Man wrote in and said, does God want me to have cancer? Now, my, you know, initial reaction was no. But as I'm reading the article, it said, not necessarily, but perhaps yes. And I thought, what are you talking about? Why would God want people to have cancer? And Billy Graham's answer was, it'll make you more spiritual. See, everything's going well in your life. You won the lottery. You got all the money and everything you want. Then God says, okay, here's a problem for you. Now you'll come home again. Say, back to me. And that's the sad part, you know, that we would think that way. And I, let me say this to people. I learned from Maimonides, Jewish philosopher and physician from several hundred years ago. He said, if people have a disease, it means they have lost their health. And the Bible tells us to restore what our neighbor has lost if we find it. And so I will often say to people, if you lose your car keys, God want you to walk home? And they look at you and laugh. I said, no, I look for my keys. Okay, you've lost your health. Let's go look for that now, too. Not God taking it away or wanting you to be sick. So I want people to remember that. If you lose your health, go look for it. And the other thing that Maimonides said that impressed me and how little improvement we have had, I think this was 900 years ago. If people took as good care of themselves as they do their animals, they would suffer fewer illnesses. That blew my mind because I fancy magazine. We have a house full of pets. Teaches a reverence for life to all our kids that way. But anyway, the woman wrote to Cat Fancy magazine saying she and her husband smoke. They have 9 cats. One died of lung cancer. The others are having breathing problems. And at the end of this page of her saga with the cats, she said, Doug and I now smoke in the yard. We love our cats more than the convenience of smoking indoors. We are not killing our cats anymore. We hope you're not killing yours. Now, at the end, I presume that the magazine would mention something about their rather unhealthy behavior and thinking, saying it's okay to kill yourself, but take care of your cats. And they didn't. So I wrote them a letter, which they, of course, refused to publish, pointing out that, you know, people are as important as cats, too. But again, it's Cat Fancy Magazine. So, you know, they're not interested in people, just the cats. But that you wonder, how can people go ahead and kill themselves while taking care of their beloved cats? Why don't they love themselves? And then we get back to the parenting and the messages they're brought up with. You're a failure. You embarrass us. You're never going to amount to anything. You know, what I call mottos to die by that people have heard. Because I had parents who gave me what I call mottos to live by because of all the troubles they had to survive. I assumed other people grew up with those kinds of things, too. And I may say I wasn't thrilled with what my parents told me, you see, because if you come home having a lousy day at school and you say, Ma, I had a terrible day at school, God is redirecting you. Something good will come of this. I mean, what kind of mother is that? What help is that? See, but, you know, Norman Vincent Peale became a friend of mine. His mother would say to him, Norman, if God slams one door further down the corridor, another will be opened. Okay. He was getting the same message. So you looked at life in a different way. And many times I realized, hey, my mother had a good point. Look what happened because of the problem. You know, something good had came up. And it just kept your mind open. Also, it was do what will make you happy, which is part of what I mentioned, that she forced me to pay attention to feelings. You know, it could be what should I be when I grow up? What girl should I ask out on a date? I mean, honey, do what'll make you happy. And my father's father died of tuberculosis with 6 kids and no insurance. And he taught me about material things, that we were here to make the world a better place for people, not to accumulate money or bigger house or cars, but help the world, you know, lend things to people. Help them survive. And they were very exceptional people. And I'm very grateful to how I grew up. But it also caused me trouble when, again, I started trying to help others. I assumed they had parents like I had. And I realized, no, they don't. They're living with abuse, you see. As one woman said, when I asked her to describe what it was like to experience cancer, she said failure. And what I've learned is to ask people, how does that word fit your life? She said, well, my body failed. I said, that's not my question. How does failure fit your life? Oh, my parents committed suicide when I was a child. I must have been a failure as a child. Boom. And her life changed from that moment on because she started living, stopped fearing relationships and being hurt. And they may add, you know, when I get back to that other book called The Art of Healing with many drawings, I mean, she was sent to me by her plastic surgeon who had operated on her for cancer, and because she was screaming at him for making her ugly. And he said, you know, she isn't ugly. People don't even know she has an operation unless she's in a bathing suit. Would you talk to her? And that's when that came out. And her drawing of herself was this really sharp, masculine individual. One of our kids said to me one day, the drawing was lying on my desk, Dad, if you hug her, you'll puncture yourself. I thought, how intuitive these kids are. You know, but she was so sharp and muscular and, you know, rigid. And he felt it when he looked at her drawing. But at least all her parts were there, if you know what I mean. So I knew she was capable of changing. And, but it's sad that you have to get cancer to wake up. And that's when everybody starts writing books, too. I get innumerable books that are all saying the same thing. And I don't mean the books aren't good, but I always say, look for common themes. If it said it in the Bible, and then some philosopher, and then some book that somebody writes when they get a life-threatening illness, hey, they're all saying the same thing because it works. So pay attention. And hey, you don't have to keep...
Hey, Bernie, I got to ask you a question. excuse me, I got to ask you a question because I'll forget. You know, you talked about a couple about imprinting early on, the parenting, all those things, and you thought you had to realize that other people didn't have the same parents as you. You know, Ruiz talks about that. He talks about domestication. How do we not get, you know, how do you not do that? You can't be proactive. You didn't really pick your parents. So where do we, until it's a catastrophe almost, we don't learn other ways. Is that, well, I mean, that's what you found, right?
I mean, if I were in charge, I always say, I wish I were the Surgeon General, because I would change parenting. You know, I don't know that I could say you need a license if you want parents, you know, to be parents, but I would not have just, you know, the delivery classes where people talk to about what goes on while you're birthing, you know, the birthing classes. I would have raising children classes. How do you raise children? How do you talk to them? What do you say to them? How do you bring in humor? How do you bring in love? So that, and it doesn't mean, and I always say, we're not talking about liking everything your kids do, but we're talking about you loving them, see? And that we then become coaches, what I call life coaches for each other. Oh, and we become love warriors. You know, that love becomes your weapon, how you deal with them. And if they know it's coming from love, they will accept it with time. And I mean that. They may not like what you're saying. I mean, I just all these examples pop into my head. One of our kids came home one day and said, oh, I'm buying a motorcycle. I said, excuse me. As a surgeon, I see what happens to people when they have accidents on motorcycles. If you get a motorcycle, I can't handle it. You'll have to move out. And I didn't mean that in a cruel way. I said, but because if the phone rings and I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, is it, has Jeffrey been in an accident? And we talked and he gave me such a hard time about it. And that's the part that I found fascinating. He really gave me such a hard time. You know, I had to give a sermon. Then he goes outside, and I'm believing he's going to go and do it. And he had a group of friends who were waiting for him, and he said, okay, we're not getting a motorcycle. And he gave my speech to his friends, and none of them went out and got a motorcycle. Now, I'm not against people having a motorcycle, okay? But, yeah, wear your helmet, you know, I mean, be safe and careful. But, again, it's because of my experience as a surgeon and the risks I felt. But he tested me. He knew it was coming from love. It made a difference. I had a teenager in a car behind me screaming obscenities at me because of the traffic, and it, like it was my fault. This was on a vacation up in Cape Cod. I said to a cop, can you tell him to be quiet? Cop said, it's not my job. I couldn't believe a police officer would say that when this kid is screaming obscenities out in the street from his car. So I got out of the car with our kids yelling he could have a gun. And I went over to him and I said, I'd like you to know something. I love you. I'm sorry your parents don't. And I got back in my car. What do you think he did? He made a U-turn and drove away. Now, some people think I was cruel to add about his parents, but my hope is that made him stop and think about why he is who he is. And he could have gone home, see, and talked to his parents. Or abandoned all the wounds that they've given to him. You don't have to hang on to them. You can reparent yourself. You could create that new life. But those are the things that become so important. And when the kids know you love them, they forgive you. I mean, we have 5 kids in 7 years, which included twins. I mean, I got sick. My wife got sick. I realized it was so stressful for us to try to take care of them. And I, you know, we're not the best parents in the world when all that happened so quickly. But again, the kids forgave us. I'm laughing again because what popped into my head, what the kids learned to say to me was, Dad, you're not in the operating room now. What did that mean? It meant I was a pain in the butt to them. I was becoming over-controlling and overbearing. You see, so they became my coach. They didn't say, Dad, you don't know what you're saying. You don't know what you're doing. You're all wrong. They would just look at me and say, Dad, you're not in the operating room now. And I would quiet right down and you know, learn from them. And I would say some crazy humorous things to them, too. One that I love was, do you know why your mother and I will never get a divorce? And they'd look up and say, no, why not? because neither one of us wants the children. And then we'd all laugh, and they knew, okay, we need to quiet down. Dad is about to, come apart. But, because when they'd be in some hassle or... But again, the humor. The twins were born with a hearing impairment due to my wife, Bobby, being exposed to German measles. And it affected the twins. And one day, the five of them were having, I don't know what was going on in the kitchen, but the noise and the arguments. And so I walk in the kitchen, I say, you may choose peace or you may choose conflict. And our daughter, with her hearing impairment, immediately answered, I'll have pizza. And then everybody burst out laughing.
Yeah.
And they've never forgotten that moment, see? Because as soon as you laugh, you're not angry anymore. And that's what I learned, to be a kid with them and to embarrass them. Again, for parents, yes, embarrass your children regularly in public so people know you're not normal. Why? Because our children have come home and said, hey, Dad, thanks. I said, for what? I haven't done anything. Yeah, I did something crazy at school today. You know what the teacher said? What? You know who his father is? And he wasn't punished. See? And one of them came home from work and said he heard the same thing there. You know, he did something crazy, and he heard people say, well, you know who his father is. So they were forgiven because of me. You know, if they have my genes, what do you expect? It's not their fault. So embarrass your children. And then they're free to be who they want to be. And I'll tell you one other way you can learn that I learned, not expecting it, but I did, talking to high school students. And I said, okay, for homework, I want you to write a suicide note and I want you to write a love note. Why you should commit suicide and why you're worth loving. And I said, you don't have to sign them. Just bring them in, the next meeting we have. And I couldn't believe it. The suicide pile was like 3 to 5 times higher than the love pile. See, that's when I began to wake up to what people were going through. See, the black eye. Oh, yeah, I fell off my bike. No, his father punched him, but he doesn't want to tell anybody that because he thinks everybody else in the class has nice parents. But what happened in one school system when they started doing that regularly, the suicide rate went down. See, because then the kids start talking to each other. So going to school can become therapy, too. And that's why school teachers can make such an enormous difference to let kids know that they're worth something. It's not just whether you get 100 on the test, but it's who you are worthwhile.
Hey, we talk about, you mentioned in a lot of your writings, or at least a number of them, because I've checked, you talk about what would Lassie do, whether you're talking about not judging or... kind of unconditional love.
Yeah. As I said, our house, we broke all the zoning laws. It was very interesting. I didn't know we were breaking them. But veterinarians used to give us all kinds of exotic pets that people didn't want anymore. And I didn't realize this was against the law to have these in your house. I mean, we had, let me explain to people. We're living, acre and a half. The front yard is fenced in with goats and ducks and geese and all kinds of creatures. And the house is filled with also loads of creatures. They all had a name. They were all family. But it taught the kids a reverence for life. That was one thing. That life was significant and important. And I may add that if you want to test yourself, what do you do after the rain when you see a worm lying on the sidewalk? Well, Schweitzer and I do the same thing. We pick it up and put it back on the ground. And think about that, see, how you feel. And I know that our kids feel that way about life. But we were never stopped by the police, so to speak, and reported for breaking the zoning laws because the police knew we were doing it out of love for all these creatures. So even when I would call them and say, some bizarre creature is missing, they didn't say, you shouldn't have a skunk in the house. You shouldn't have a kinkajou in the house. Why? They just said, okay, if a neighbor calls, we'll let you know. And, they would help us. But what did you learn from the animals? Well, let me, one, forgiveness. I brought a rabbit home that we rescued. And I thought it had gotten to know the dog, and the dog had gotten to know the rabbit. So we go shopping one day, come home, and the rabbit was all bruised. And it was obvious the dog had grabbed her as if she were a stuffed animal. And I just felt so terrible that I hadn't, you know, closed off the front yard and the pet door and that kind of thing. But 2 weeks later, I go out to bring the rabbit in. And, you know, I call her name and I can't find her. And this is a fenced-in front yard. Let me say our house is shaped like a C, so there's a fence across the front. So it's a closed-in special area there, too. And I see the dog sitting there, and I walk over, and where's the rabbit? Cuddled against the dog behind him. And I thought, wow, what a message of forgiveness.
Yeah.
Here, he has threatened her life by grabbing her, and she's using him now as a friend to hide behind her, him. And that impressed the hell out of me. And that's why when I say to people, when you don't know what to do, ask yourself, WWLD, what would Lassie do? And then go and do it. Because animals are complete. That comes from a member of the clergy who said, the word good is not translated properly in the Bible. It should be that animals are complete and that man is not, that we still have a lot to learn. And I always think about that little kid whose dog was going to be euthanized, and the vet said, do you know why dogs have a shorter life than people? And this little pipsqueak looks up at everybody and says, yes, I know. And the vet is stunned. You know? Yes, they know about love and kindness and forgiveness. It takes us a long time to learn it.
Yeah. Hey, Bernie, you're getting quiet, so I wanted to remind you that. I didn't want to interrupt you, so speak up if
sorry,
you can.
Oh, sorry, but yeah, I got into my trance thinking of all these stories. And yeah. You see, but even that's why the WWLD, when I start thinking of the animals, it puts me in a different place. Mm-hmm. Let's get scientific for a minute. You pet a furry animal. Your oxytocin and serotonin levels go up. Those are the bonding hormones that are increased after a woman gives birth. So, I mean, anybody listening to this who has a dog knows, you walk down the street with a dog, everybody talks to you. You walk by yourself, you don't get that kind of reaction. I do things at the assisted living facility, and if I go over there with the dog, every resident talks to the dog. And to me, you know, what's his name? Oh, he's cute. Can I pet him? You know, and we all, but if I go there alone, I don't get that kind of reaction from all the residents. So it makes a difference. And then a study done in Australia, you have a heart attack. You go home to a house with a dog. A year later, 5% of the people had died. You have a heart attack. You go home to a house with no dog. 26% of the people had died a year later. Now, what I love is that Australian physician sounded like me. He said, if we could get everybody in Australia to have a dog, we'd save millions and millions of dollars in health care. But again, it's the relationships. Why women live longer than men with the same cancers. It ain't their hormones. It's, you know, that are protecting them. Because one doctor said, oh, it must be their hormones having some beneficial effect. Well, married men live longer than single men. So I said, so sleeping with female hormones is protecting them? It's relationships. You know, whether it's a married man, a woman, it's relationships. And again, a study. What are the characteristics of people who live to be 100? Number one on the list was they are members of a clan. In other words, they belong to a group, the relationships. Number two, there was a sense of purpose in their life. Number three, they ate a reasonably healthy diet. You know, they weren't neurotic about it. And number four, they were active. And again, they said it didn't mean they went to a gym, but they were active people. And we read all these articles about how bad it is to sit, you know, at your desk or in front of your computer all day long. So those four simple things, and you are more likely to live to be 100. You know, nothing profound. You didn't have to take 45 different supplements every day and things of that sort. Doesn't mean I don't do I don't mean 45, but I mean that I don't take certain vitamins, minerals, other things that I know are good for me and help my body, you know, and help me stay young and that type of thing. You know, I think about it. And if it makes sense, hey, okay to take a pill. And it's up to the person. I mean, I know people who took 98 supplements a day, which could drive you nuts all the time he spent. But that was something he did and his way of dealing with cancer. And, yeah, he was a survivor. See, the list, there's something on my website, BernieSiegelMD.com, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-D.com, called Immune Competent Personality. It sounds very much like what you need to do if you want to live to be 100, right? That you have a sense of purpose, you know, meaning in your life. That you ask friends and family for help if you need it. You express anger appropriately in defense of yourself. So you care for yourself. You make decisions about therapy. You don't let others impose everything on you. You have play in your life. You know, the chocolate, what I call the chocolate ice cream. And you have, as I say, a sense of meaning, not living a role, that you're not mama, you're not the wage earner, you're a person living an authentic life. And again, you use your feelings, you learn from your difficulties. I always compare it to hunger, because just as I say, what would Lassie do? I'd say, how do you feel when you're hungry? I get something to eat. Okay, then ask yourself what nourishment you need to bring into your life when you don't like how you're feeling. See, then the curse becomes a blessing. See, then when you say to people, what are you going through? It's been a wake-up call, a blessing, a new beginning. Again, a simple example. A woman was about to be admitted to the hospital with severe migraine headaches for several weeks. I stopped for a minute to talk to her. She wasn't my patient, but I wanted to try to help ease the pain. So I said to her, what is the pain like? She said, pressure. And then I did some imagery to alleviate the pressure in her life. And I left her. Nurse came over to me about 15 minutes later and said, her headache's gone. She's on the way home. It's her marriage. That impressed me. Okay? I didn't discuss it with her, but I brought that word up, pressure. And she knew what it was in her life. Okay? Then if I said to her, what's it like now? She said it was a gift. See, she might change it to gift, wake-up call, new beginning. Thank you. So learn to listen to people. I'll give you a test question. I don't know if I've ever asked you this. If you had to be blind or deaf tomorrow morning, which would you pick?
I think I know the right answer now. I think you did ask me that once before. So yeah. And I just kind of whipped one out. But, you know, blind is the answer.
Yeah. And from Helen Keller, whose work I love, if you want to, again, learn how to deal with life, somebody who's blind and deaf from the age of 4, I mean, why isn't she bitter, resentful, hating God and everybody? Instead, what a wonderful person. You know, learning from God. She called it chastising, that God is teaching her things. But her quote was, I've heard of the stars, the rainbows, the play of light on the waves, these I would like to see. But far more than sight, I wish for my ears to be open. The voice of a friend, the imaginations of Mozart. Life without these is darker by far than blindness. Boy, did she wake me up. Yeah. And I learned to listen to people. And then I get thanked for saying nothing. I mean, this may sound crazy, but I don't make up any of these stories. I mean, a woman talked to me for an hour and a half, and I never said anything but, yes, oh my. At the end of an hour and a half, she said, that's the greatest conversation I've ever had with anyone. And I hadn't said a single word. But she heard herself, see? So keep your journal of your feelings. So you talk to yourself all the time. So you don't store your life in your body. Because, again, Alice Miller, the psychologist, say our childhood is stored up in our bodies. You know, although we can repress it, you know, we can't alter it. And our body can be tricked with medication. And she goes on and on, but ends with, and someday the body will present its bill. For it is as incorruptible as a child who, while still whole in spirit, will accept no compromises. And it will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. Boom. And that is so true.
Boom.
And let me give you one other quote, too. If you want to have an interesting experience, go shopping. Go to a supermarket with a bandage over your eye. Or go to work, you know, with a bandage, or school, or wherever, with a bandage, visible bandage. And watch how many people talk to you about their troubles and woundedness. See? And I know this from an example that happened to me at Stop and Shop, where a lady said, "You're the only person who hasn't asked me what happened." And she had a bandage over her eye. That impressed the hell out of me. I mean, my sense of humor, I said to her, "Well, I have an abusive spouse also, so I know what happened to you." And then I explained to her, I was a doctor, so the bandage didn't affect me the way it affected everybody else. But Thornton Wilder wrote a beautiful story called The Pool at Bethesda. An angel refuses to heal a doctor. And the doctor says, "Why? Because I'm a doctor, you're not going to help me?" And the angel says, "No. Without your wound, where would your power be? It's your melancholy that makes your low voice tremble into the hearts of men. The very angels themselves cannot persuade the wretched and blundering children on earth, as can one human being broken on the wheels of living. In love service, only the wounded soldier can serve. Draw back." And the doctor turns and leaves while other people are entering the pool and being healed. But on the way home, the doctor wakes up because he notices as he's walking down the street how many front doors of houses open up and people yell, "Come in here. Our daughter sits in the dark and only talks to you. Come in here. Our son is locked in his bedroom. He only comes out when you're here." And he realizes what a difference he is making because of his woundedness. So I'd say to people, don't hide your wounds. Don't focus on them. I mean, you're not your wound. But the fact that you have one means you can understand the experience of others. And then they can share with you and talk to you. So you're the native, not the tourist. And again, unfortunately, as doctors, we tend to be tourists. We don't understand what people are going through. When I was a patient, I learned a lot. I've operated on some of our children. I was a pediatric surgeon. And one of our kids, after I showed him the whole hospital and all the people he'd meet and everything else, and I'm standing next to him in the recovery room, and he woke up, looked at me, and said, "You forgot to tell me it was going to hurt." Oh, that broke my heart. See? Here's a four-year-old making me a better doctor. To realize it's not just all the people and the rooms and the technology, it's how I'm going to feel. So I've learned, you know, to listen and to learn. And I may add, if you want to know you're a good soul, you are criticized by the people you work with, the people you work for, and your family. Now, what is that? Why does that make you a good person? Because they know you're listening and learning from your mistakes. Because if you keep making excuses, "Hey, Dad, no, it's not my fault. That's you. You don't know how to behave. You're the problem, not me." Then they stop talking to you, see? Or if a patient says, "There's something I'd like to share with you." "Well, I'm too busy. I don't have time." Then they give up on you, and the nurses do. And I learned from my patients and others who would tell me, one, I mean, just that was humorous because I was really worried about this lady and what to do for her. When I walked into her room, she said, "What's wrong?" I said, what do you mean? She said, "Your face, I mean, it's all wrinkled and tight." And I said, "Yeah, I'm thinking about how am I going to help you." She said, "Think in the hallway and smile when you come in here." You see, I scared her.
Yeah.
And that never occurred to me, but she taught me, you know, how to be a better doctor and to help people. And so I'd say, don't see criticism as something negative. See it, again, as coming from a coach. Now, I don't mean somebody saying to you, "You're a terrible person." That doesn't help. But when they tell you why they feel that way, what you did that made them feel that way, then you can think about, okay, how do I change that approach and behave differently?
You know, you sharing these stories, all these experiences, Bernie, it's something that's, you know, from years of your experience, but you've had a purpose it seems to me, for a long, long time. You found that, or I don't think you just were born with that, but you were open up enough to it. What you just mentioned, you know, to be open to criticism and to be open to learning.
Yeah, to keep searching, you know, and learning. One of my patients who was in hospice, and I was visiting him, and one day he was not demented, but so people understand, as I was leaving after visiting him, he said, "Okay, Journey." He stopped calling me Bernie and started calling me Journey. I thought, boy, is that therapeutic. I am on a journey. We're all on a trip. And I see life now as a school, and that we're all here to raise our level of consciousness, because consciousness does not die, folks. That's why we have near-death experiences. That's why we talk about past lives, because the consciousness of those who have preceded us becomes a part of us, you see. I call it impregnating us. So I know, partly, I became a doctor. I mean, people may think I'm nuts by the time this show is over, but I almost choked to death as a four-year-old, so I had a near-death experience many years ago when it wasn't, you know, a big thing. So I didn't talk to anybody about it. I was just mad as hell I didn't die, because it was so interesting to leave your body and not be choking. I had a past life experience. Again, when somebody said to me on the phone, "Why are you living this life?" Now, she said it because I was so busy being interviewed, going off and lecturing and running all over the place. "Why are you living this life?" I went into a trance and said to her, "Oh, my God, I see myself with a sword in my hand killing people." And I'll tell you, I had one of the most emotional experiences of my entire life. It was like watching a movie of yourself. I cried for hours. But I really felt that that may be a part of why I'm a surgeon, to cure with a knife, to help people with a knife, not to kill. And I may add, even some animals I killed, you know, like people's pets. If they had a dog and I went to kill them and the dog came at me, I killed it. And I thought, maybe that's why your house was the way it was. You know, that you're making up for all of this. But you see, if our level of consciousness rises, then I always say it's like going from 10th grade, you know, to college. And then you will create a better world because your consciousness will be elevated. And I always point out to high school students, especially, what do we call a graduation? Well, we call it a commencement. I said, why do we do that? You're finished. Why don't you invite people to come to your termination? You know, and they look at you. I said, yeah, remember that, please. That life is a series of beginnings. It's a commencement. And if people see it in that way, then it becomes a very different experience. You know, that, and again, whether you're a Helen Keller or someone who's lost a limb or other things happen, you say, okay, when you have the courage to say to yourself, what am I to learn from this experience? I mean, Joseph Campbell said, when you're going through hell, ask yourself, what am I to learn from this? And that's something I've learned to do. People have to understand, I got plenty of problems too. I do a lot of caregiving. My wife has had multiple sclerosis for, I don't know, maybe 50 years, okay? See, that again taught me something. I mean, I can remember her neurologist telling me what's going to happen to her. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to tell her. So I lied to my wife about, you know, the future. And I realized that doesn't work either. You can't keep lying. You got to tell the truth. But I learned that doctors don't know the future. It's not statistical. And so I got into holistic medicine and other things and realized, you know, all these things were my teachers. But right now, yes, I'm doing caregiving, but, you know, I'm still the doctor. So, I don't know, a couple of years ago, my wife was sitting at the table in the kitchen and said, "Honey, get me a drink of water." I said, "You should be more active, so you get up and go get a drink." And did I feel good? I mean, that I know was the Dr. Siegel talking. And I felt terrible for saying that. My wife wasn't very happy either. Yeah. But I thought, okay, what do you learn from this? And it's, you need to be more compassionate. And not just the doctor, but her husband. So, honey, can you get me a glass of water? Sure. And I run over, get it, you know, get a big kiss. And it feels so wonderful. Now, are there times that, yes, I will push her and say, okay, we got to do our exercise, you know, before we go to the kitchen for breakfast or something like that. Yeah. I mean, there are certain things I will make noise about and point out to her. It's important for her health. But on the other hand, I keep asking myself, what's significant? So it isn't just about treating the disease, that there are days, okay, skip the exercise. I mean, she's had other things. I won't get into her health. But that, yes, I will change her medical treatment when I see the treatment depriving us of having a nice day. You know, the disease is less of a problem than the treatment or the threat of the disease. And again, it's making those decisions based on how can we have the healthiest and happiest day, you know? So I try to tell people, don't try to not die. See, one of the things I've learned from my work in heaven, where I consult often, and, you know, I saw so many bitter people in heaven, I couldn't believe it. So I went over to one guy, I said, why are you so unhappy up in heaven? He said, look, I used to get up 5 o'clock in the morning and run 10 miles. I ate vegetables for 23 years. I meditated 4 times a day. And look what happened to me. I died. He said, if I knew I was going to die, I would have slept late and had a lobster once in a while. So I try to tell people, don't try to not die. It doesn't work. See? Then you'll feel like a failure. And think how many times you see the headlines. You know, so-and-so, you know, fails, loses battle. No, Mother Teresa said it very well. I will not attend an anti-war rally, but if you ever have a peace rally, call me. So, folks, work at healing your life and your body. Love your life, love your body. That's what it's about. It's not about trying to not die and empowering your enemy with battles, you know, fighting all the time. Heal. I had a Quaker, conscientious objector, as a patient. When he went to the oncologist said to him, see, he doesn't know him as a person. So he thinks he's telling him something wonderful. I'm going to give you chemotherapy and it will kill your cancer. Dave said, I'm a Quaker. I'm a conscientious objector. I don't kill anything. Goodbye. And he walked out of the office. Now, he lived for over 12 years doing other things. But in his drawing, which I asked him to do, he is carrying the cancer cells away. See? He's not hurting them. He's carrying them in the arms of his white blood cells. His immune system is carrying them away. And I found that so impressive because I said to him, hey, you could have soldiers, you could have police, you could have, you know, people protecting you. No, no, he could not hurt anyone. And so, or anything, he was carrying them away, like Mother Teresa's approach. And I'd say that to people. Now, I have to add, there are kids who, you know, because of all the crazy games we have today, yeah, they'll, you know, shoot down, you know, airplanes that may be their cancer. And to them, though, it's a different image, if you know what I mean. It's not a violent war. It's what they grew up with. So there are kids who will use those, you might say, military images and do very well. But as adults, we're not killers. We're not killers. When we read the headlines, it's about revenge. You know, all the latest headlines, see. People, this is from East of Eden by John Steinbeck. We all experience rejection. With rejection comes a desire for revenge. With revenge, guilt. And there is the story of mankind. Okay, and that's why if all of these children, you know, these teenagers and others who go into churches, schools, movies, and kill people. It's revenge. If they grew up with love, if they grew up with a reverence for life, they would not be doing that. And that's why use love as your weapon. So if you meet one of those kids, say, I love you. It'll make it a lot harder for them to hurt you. Believe me.
Bernie, it's been another some kind of hour, I'll tell you, man. You know, I could listen to you for, and again, you're an excellent guest because I really just get captivated and I don't have to say much.
Well, you know, let me say this. I don't do the talking. It comes from another level.
Yeah.
Let me close with this mystical experience, okay? I did a guided imagery. We'll go back to Carl Simonton because I thought some of what he was doing was nuts. You know, we'll close our eyes and we'll visualize. And one of the exercises was to walk down a path and meet an inner guide. And I thought, I'm a doctor, Moses, Jesus, you know, show up, somebody interesting. And this guy walked up to me with a big beard and spiritual garments on and said, my name is George. I thought, what? Who is this? George. But hey, okay, so your name is George. And every now and then, George would talk to me, literally. He'd appear, I'd hear his voice telling me things. And then about 2 years after that experience, I was out lecturing. And I realized one night, like my talking to you, see, I don't prepare this, it just flows. I got up and I started talking. And I realized you're not following your notes, your outline, your, you know. But I thought, what the hell? What I'm saying seems better than my notes and outline. Just go ahead. So I just kept talking for 2 hours. At the end of it, a woman came up to me and said, that was better than usual. I've heard you before. I said, I agree with you. It was different. And then the next woman came up and said, there was a man standing in front of you for the entire lecture, so I drew his picture for you. And it's George. And he's not a normal-looking guy. You know what I mean? With his beard and other things. And all this she drew. Then another year or two went by. I was speaking at a Christian funeral of that man who said, called me Journey. When he died, I spoke at his funeral. And after it, a healer named Olga Worrell, she's a wonderful mystic, and she got to be a friend of mine, and she also knew this gentleman. And she came up to me in the hallway and said, Bernie, are you Jewish? I said, why are you asking me? Because I spoke at a Christian funeral on Sunday. She said, no, there's a rabbi standing next to you. And it was George. Now, we're standing in an empty hallway, okay? And I realized then why he was dressed the way he was, with his prayer cap and his robes and everything. And then it all made perfect sense, you know, who he is. So, yeah, I talk to him all the time now. He's there for me. But I may add, we could talk about healing next time, because I had an injury and Olga Worrell was lecturing at a holistic medical conference. And my wife said, why don't you ask her to heal you? And I said, you see, yeah, beliefs. I said, honey, I don't believe in what she's saying. It all sounds crazy to me. So my wife went over to her and said, Olga, would you take care of my husband? And she came over, put her hands on my leg. The heat was incredible. Within 5 minutes, I got up and walked away perfectly well from an injury. So again, I don't deny. See, once that happens, how can I not believe what she did? So I'd say to people, again, keep your mind open. Be like the still pond, and you'll see the truth reflected back to you.
Bernie, thank you so much. I'm speechless, and I like it like that. Maybe George showed up tonight, too, I guess, you know.
There is no question.
Well, I feel honored to have met George as well. You know, always a great blessing. You really do a lot of good for a lot of people. We just really thank you so much.
Next time, again, for humor, remember this, who my angel is. Because I have been in 3 serious accidents in which I could have been killed or seriously injured. Falling off the roof 2 times, my car has been totaled, and I've walked away. So next time we get together, remind me to tell you who my angel is. I have one besides George.
Hey, I'll take you up on that, Bernie. You know that. So I appreciate that.
All
we'll
right.
plan for
Thank
another
you.
One. Thank you so much. Absolutely. Thank Bobby Forrest, too, for letting me go for an hour. We appreciate it.
All right. Bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There you have it, Dr. Bernie Siegel. What a guy. You can learn all about Dr. Bernie Siegel at BernieSiegelMD.com. We really appreciate everybody listening to the show and the people that are going to listen to the show. We couldn't do it without you, and certainly without all our guests. Get over to the website, TremendousLifeRadio.com. We have a vault there filled with hundreds now, I guess, past archived conversations. You can also search iTunes. Just search Tremendous Life Radio. Until next time, make it a great day.